Welcome to the eLaborate Topics podcast, where we focus on lab-specific strategies for medical laboratory professionals. We're proud to be the healthcare detectives that work behind the scenes to get the results needed to influence medical decisions. Let's grow together and jump right into the lab.
Welcome to another episode of eLaborate Topics podcast. I am your host, Lona Small. eLaborate Topics is a weekly podcast where myself and my co-host, Tywana Wilson, and Stephanie Whitehead bring to you tips and tools and guests, an awesome guest, to help you to excel both inside and outside the lab. And today we have an awesome guest. And she's Zoe Brooks. She's CEO, visionary of Awesome Numbers, Inc. And that's transforming statistical QC to automated risk management. And Zoe's going to talk to us about how we can upgrade our lab statistical quality control to reduce risk and healthcare costs. So we have awesome and exciting on a little different topic, and Zoe's going to help us through that. So welcome, Zoe.
Thank you very much, Lona. I'm delighted to be with you.
All right. So we have a lot of exciting things to talk about. So we're going to jump in. And Zoe, tell the listeners, tell us about yourself. Why that interest that you have in quality control? Tell us about that.
I think, Lona, I was just born with it. I'm fascinated by quality control. I started work in medical labs, believe it or not, 50 years ago. And I have seen the evolution of quality control from, you know, the 2SD charts. I've seen peer review come in. I've seen the introduction of WestGuard rules. I've lived with computerization. I brought computers into six small labs that I was working with. And I've seen the difference that it can make. And it's just a fascinating topic when you take it apart, play with it, and see what can be done.
Awesome. So I know that for you, you're doing a lot of work when it comes to quality control, and you're looking at risk management, and you're looking at cost. And I know that I've listened to one of your talks, and you were comparing that whole thing to Six Sigma when it comes to accuracy and other things. So when you think of what you're doing right now, when it comes to risk management, how do you relate that to quality control? Because your big thing on reducing risk, how do you relate it to quality control? How do you relate that to cost? And how do you relate that to Six Sigma?
Well, let's take that one step at a time. How it's different than quality control is that risk management focuses on prevention, and it deals with how much risk is acceptable, which in a way is an exciting or an interesting question unto itself. If you buy a pair of shoes, you kind of figure that somebody has examined that pair of shoes, that they've passed quality control, and it's the aim of the shoe company to not ship you any bad shoes. Mm-hmm. And yet in the medical lab, we have acceptable risk levels. People will tell you it's okay, it's good for a method to be three sigma. And then they'll turn around and they'll tell you that three sigma is equal to a 6.7% error rate. Would you like to buy a pair of shoes where the odds are 6.7% you're going to get a bad one?
Awesome. And, never look at it that way.
Yeah. And it has to do with the foolishness that goes along with Six Sigma in the statistical assumptions, the subtraction of 1.5 SD, which has no proof in medical labs whatsoever. And it's all tied up in statistics where risk management is 100% clinically based. It tells you that an incorrect result is a result that doesn't meet the needs of its medical utility. And it spells out over and over and over again what the definitions are for acceptable risk, acceptable error. It's all based on medical need. If I could do something a little bit perhaps unusual for your audience, I would like to share with them a poem that I have been using for years to try and get people to look at prevent the risk, don't just pick up your errors once they've already happened. This poem was written in 1895. It's called An Ambulance Down in the Valley. 'Twas a dangerous cliff, as they freely confessed, though to walk near its crest was so pleasant, but over its terrible edge there had slipped a duke and full many a peasant. So the people said something would have to be done, but their projects did not at all tally. Some said, put a fence round the edge of the cliff, some an ambulance down in the valley. But the cry for the ambulance carried the day, for it spread through the neighboring city. A fence may be useful or not, it is true, but each heart became brimful of pity for those who had slipped over that dangerous cliff, and the dwellers in highway and alley gave pounds or gave pence, not to put up a fence, but an ambulance down in the valley. For the cliff is all right if you're careful, they said, and if folks even slip and are dropping, it isn't the slipping that hurts them so much as the shock down below when they're stopping. So day after day, as these mishaps occurred, quick forth would these rescuers sally to pick up the victims who fell off the cliff with their ambulance down in the valley. Then an old sage remarked, it's a marvel to me that people give far more attention to repairing results than to stopping the cause when they'd far better aim at prevention. Let us stop at its source, all this mischief, cried he. Come neighbors and friends, let us rally. If the cliff we will fence, we might almost dispense with the ambulance down in the valley. Oh, he's a fanatic, the others rejoined. Dispense with the ambulance, never. He'd dispense with all charities, too, if he could. No, no, we'll support them forever. Aren't we picking up folks just as fast as they fall? And should this man dictate to us, shall he? Why should people of sense stop to put up a fence while the ambulance works in the valley? But a sensible few who are practical, too, will not bear with such nonsense much longer. They believe that prevention is better than cure, and their party will soon be the stronger. Encourage them then with your purse, voice, and pen, and while other philanthropists dally, they will scorn all pretense and put up a stout fence on the cliff that hangs over the valley. Better guide well the young than reclaim them when old, for the voice of true wisdom is calling. To rescue the fallen is good, but is best to prevent other people from falling. Better close up the source of temptation and crime and then deliver from dungeon or galley. Better put a strong fence round the top of the cliff than an ambulance down in the valley.
Wow. Awesome.
It's so true. We wait, we detect errors after they've occurred. But if we so choose, we can design our quality control systems that when a failure occurs, zero patients are reported and zero errors are created that add healthcare cost and harm your patients. And it's all a simple matter of when all else fails, follow the manual. It's written in CLSI EP23A. It is written in ISO 15189. But, you know, when you say, why don't people do this, part of the reason is how many people get to read those documents. You know, they're expensive. They're mm-hmm. out of reach of many labs. And if they are in reach in the labs, they're in reach in the manager's or the director's office. But the people on the bench who are making the decisions, and that's another problem in quality control, is that every person thinks it's their right to design their own QC system. There is one best way to manage quality control. I did a survey once. I asked people, where do you get your mean? Where do you get your SD? Where do you get your QC rules? They came up with 192 different ways that people do QC. There's one right way.
No standardized way at all. No. And I like the poem because I see that a lot, especially when we're used to seeing things done a certain way and we just never question it and we just go along with it. People are falling down the cliff. There's an ambulance. That's what we do. And nobody, there's probably one or two people may come up and say, this may be a better way. What about putting it up a fence to prevent that? And then you may have the majority of people saying, then that would mean the ambulance would lose their job. And that is very important that you're going to have more people working to put these people in the ambulance or even people dying. So why should we change that? So you're trying to prevent people from doing all these extra work that may be unnecessary and not safe and probably more risky. But a lot of people don't think outside the box. And I see where you're thinking outside the box, where you're looking, how can we reduce risk? For you, the big thing is risk. And, you know, a lot of people are like, this is how we have always done QC, but you're saying we want to do it in a way that we're reducing risk to our patients and we're preventing increased costs to healthcare in general. And lab can contribute in a big way in that sense. So explain to us how this whole the QC system that you create works in terms of how does that help with that risk? How does it relate to risk and costs? Because I know for you, it's so important reducing the risk and the cost. How does that system work to help with that?
Well, one of the things we do is we report the number of medically unreliable results per year. Not a sigma metric. Sigma metrics measure the number of medically unreliable results per million patients. If you work in a lab that tests 100 patient samples a day for that control, it would take you 27 years to reach a million patients. Who would choose a metric that gives you your risk rate in 27 years? You know, the world will change, the technology will change. In factories where they churn out a million widgets a day, sure, it's a good metric. But in medical labs where you might be testing 50 patients a day, sigma has very little to do with what you're doing and nobody understands it. Again, I do polls. I say, what's your acceptable sigma? People will go anywhere from 0 to 6. They don't realize that between 2 sigma and 3 sigma, there's about a 300%, and I don't hold me to that, but there's a huge difference. You're going from 0.135% at 3 sigma to 2.7573% at 2 sigma. That's a massive increase in the error rate. And yet we talk about 2 and 3 sigma as if they're on a, you know, they're not logarithmic, but they are logarithmic. So people don't understand. I did another poll. I said, if sigma goes down by 5%, what's going to happen to your error rate? Some people thought it went down by 5%. Some thought it went up by 5%. Nobody realized that in that example, it went up by 41%. It doesn't make sense. And it is completely impossible to relate sigma to cost of error. You can have one Six Sigma method that has an average cost of error of $19 and another Six Sigma method that has an average cost of error of $50. Because the cost of error, if you look at your gateposts, so to speak, if you look at your allowable error limits, as you progress towards that allowable error limit, your amount of cost rises, because the closer you get to the error limit, the more tests the doctor will order to say, have you crossed that error limit? You're getting close to it. And there was a huge study done by NIST and Mayo, published in 2004. They looked back at 89,000 patient charts and said, what was the calcium value? What tests did the doctor order? What did it cost healthcare? So a complete retrospective study. What we've done is worked out a mathematical way, or a math modeling way, where our projections of cost mirror what they got by looking back through 89,000 patient charts. You can't do that over and over again. But we found a way to model that cost of error. And the cost of error, as you approach your allowable error limit, the cost increases. But you've got one Six Sigma method at zero bias and another one at Six Sigma method. It's got a smaller SD, but it's still Six Sigma. It's got a huge bias, a big cost of error. Sigma is completely incapable of relating cost.
Wow. So basically, a lot of us are relying on sigma, and you're so right. A lot of us don't understand it, and when we're moving manufacturing concepts into the lab, and you're making a great point there in terms of the volumes. You cannot compare a small volume lab to a lab that's producing way more. And it's so important to look at rates, like what are you really measuring when it comes to rate? Like, you know, what's that? It's not just a percentage or just a regular denominator, but making sure that the same thing is common across all labs in terms of what's the same kind of denominator across all labs. Because if you're having different size denominator across different labs, it's not really a good reflection of, and then you're using the same standard to measure, it's not reflecting in an accurate way, the quality at all.
Add to that, there are about four different ways that are accepted to calculate sigma. They all come up with different answers. You'll see people calculating sigma and they don't include bias at all. You'll see other ones where they do include bias. It's ridiculous to not include bias. Mm-hmm. So when you model it, and that's what I do, I play with things. You know, I bring them over into Excel, I change the numbers, I make sure what's happening. That's where I first discovered, if you calculate sigma from percent bias and percent CV, if there's any bias at all, there are no real measured values that will reproduce what you get when you convert them to percent.
Wow.
Yeah.
So with this system, you're saying that when you compare the system that you use and you reproduce the study that was done years ago when it went with the calcium study, you found that as when it gets close to that last point of the is that the error rate when it gets close to that point where the cost is going up for your study?
You see, it doesn't just, it's not as if there's zero cost and then you suddenly fail the allowable error limit and cost exists. The cost increases on a steady curve from zero up to, and they found it to be $100 at the failure of the allowable error limit.
So there's some kind of consistency there versus with Six Sigma, you have erratic. Some part of it is higher. It's not a way that you can use Six Sigma to even measure the cost of error in that sense, because it's like all over the place when it comes to Sigma.
Right. The other big thing is right now people say choose an allowable error limit. You know, pick one out of the cookie jar. Here's 10 you can choose from. If you go by risk management, there's only one source of an allowable error limit, and that's a clinically significant limit. Mm-hmm. So, and it's spelled out crystal clear in the, you know, an incorrect result is a result that does not meet the requirements for its intended medical use. Note one, in the case of quantitative test procedures, a result with a failure of measurement that exceeds a limit based on medical utility. They define allowable limits of error as the amount of error that can be tolerated without invalidating the medical usefulness of an analytical result. But you come to something like calcium, you know, I tell a joke sometime about somebody saying, you know, hey, I fixed my calcium. They say, what'd you do? I got a new clinical chemist. He chose CLIA limits instead of biological variation, you know, but now I've got a horrible problem with another test. Wow. If you look at calcium, biological variation will tell you to use a limit of 2.5%, and CLIA says 1 milligram. That's 10%. At a mean of 10. So you're four times the allowable error limit if you pick CLIA from the cookie jar. But if you follow the regulations and the people who got together and wrote them, there's only one choice. You know, it goes, there was a Milan conference that said the same thing. You know, you use clinical outcome. If that's not available, use biological variation. Only if those two are not available, do you go to state of the art, which is essentially what CLIA is.
So explain to me when you're using your recommendation for how to choose allowable errors or the limits, what would you recommend for that QC system versus, like, I know so many people have different things that they use, and it's kind of confusing to me if I work in at this institution that's using one standard, somebody else is using a different standard, or even within my own institution, depending on the test, I may be using a different standard. So what do you recommend in these situations?
I'll tell you what we did, because I've been using medical allowable error limits since before CLIA was invented. So back in I met Dr. Westgaard in 89, and he and I did a workshop together in 91 in Montreal. And prior to that, I phoned him up and I said, hey, why don't you talk about your theories and I'll show how we applied all those theories in our labs. And he laughed at me and said, my, you are an optimist. But I thought, what's the point of having theories if they can't be applied? So I took his theories back then. We were using critical systematic error and QC selection grids. And I wrote a program in DOS that did the same thing. But I needed the allowable error limit. So I sat down with the lab director and I said, I need your limits to make this work. What is good enough for clinical care? So he gave me limits for everything he was comfortable with. There were some things like free T4s. He said, I'm going to go talk to the specialist and see what he says. You simply ask your medical staff. It's a medical opinion. You know, so if you have a lab director who is a qualified lab director with a medical background, you ask the medical staff what is good enough. And you won't find a hospital on one corner saying one thing and a hospital on the other corner of the street saying something else. You know, it's not up to the clinical chemist. It's not up to the statistician. We're in the business of practicing medicine. Is it fair to the clinician to think that, you know, I send my patient to this lab, they've got a completely different quality standard than the other lab they might go to? And when things fail quality standards, there's no stop sign. Nobody says if your sigma is unacceptable, stop reporting and fix it. Where we say, you know, if your number or cost of errors per year or after a simulated failure event is unacceptable, stop and fix it. Don't turn out results, you know, don't ship bad shoes. You know, you have to have a medical standard to produce a medical result. And it's within our reach. It's just once CLIA came out, nobody stopped looking. Nobody was looking. Everybody stopped looking.
Wow. So you set those standards ahead of time when it comes to risk. You're using risk and cost of error to set those standards?
I use risk as the number of medically unreliable results per year and cost as the average cost per patient result reported. And with the modeling we've done, we can reduce the average cost of error by about $3 per patient result times 10 billion lab results reported per year.
So that's so important when it comes to risk, because that's the whole goal of QC, right? You're trying to reduce risk to patients, right?
Exactly.
So that should be the focus. Like, what is it that's going to create risk to your patient? When you get there, that's when you stop reporting results.
Exactly. Exactly. One of the statements, again, in EP23A is, at the least, the ability of your QC process to detect medically allowable error should be evaluated. I thought this was wonderful that the inspectors would go around and everybody would have to evaluate their QC and finally we would take those steps forward. But it didn't happen. But we do that. When we evaluate QC, so our monthly report includes a simulated shift to fail acceptable risk. I've done posters and posters at AACC, and over and over and over again, 30% of the QC, the daily QC processes we test, would never detect a failure because people have been taught it's okay to double your SDs.
Yeah, the only time I think people are doing it is for the assays that probably don't have commercial controls or whatever, or they think that they're the few that fit on that IQCP category that they have to evaluate risk, and not all of the other really high volume or impactful that would really cause major danger and risk, those are not the ones that they're evaluating risk.
No. And are they really evaluating risk? And if so, what metrics are they using? Like, risk, by its very definition, is the combination of the probability and severity of harm. Mm-hmm. Well, you measure the probability as your odds of getting a bad result are 1 in X, and you measure the severity as to what will it cost healthcare.
Yeah. So I love that. I love that you're looking at, you're setting those standards for any QC that you do, you should be evaluating risk. And I love the added part of cost to healthcare, because of course, with risk comes cost. And I love that you're adding that to actually show that once you reduce risk, you're reducing cost to healthcare. And so tell us a little bit about, like, how much could labs save when it comes to healthcare costs by managing these risks?
I processed 104 calcium and glucose bread and butter tests. I had the true mean, the measure, the true value, the measured mean, the measured SD, and the QC rules and the chart values that the labs were using. In that case, I normalized them all to 100 patients per day per QC sample. The cost to healthcare with what they were doing now was $66 million. Hmm. What we do is we say these tests need to improve precision. These tests need to improve accuracy. Here's how to improve precision. Here's how to improve accuracy. And then we show them that if you do that, you would save $12 million on 104 QC samples for bread and butter tests. These were from 24 different labs, at least. So, you know, what will happen? Right now, we're at the stage of saying, we need people to test this live. We need to take it into labs, put it through where there's those volumes of patients going through, and just run it in parallel to what you're doing now and discover how much you can save. You know, the labs have been striving for recognition for 50 years, and we've never really achieved it. But imagine if labs collectively stepped up and said, hey, we can save billions of dollars in healthcare. It would make a difference, and it would make a difference to how labs are perceived.
You're so correct, because people look at the value for them. It's not value where you think you're contributing value, but if you contribute value in for your customers, if people perceive that value as being valuable, which is like, if we're reducing cost for healthcare, of course, they're going to like, they're really, all the work that they're doing in the lab is really reducing risk to our patients. It's saving healthcare money. Of course, we're going to be recognized as being valuable. Our perceived value is going to go up. The way we, our reimbursements will go up because it's based on perceived value or recognition, or even our the remuneration and compensation will go up if we're perceived as contributing to value in that sense. So this seemed really exciting. I wish more people knew about this. It's like, this is something that needs to go out. More labs need to know about how to actually look at QC to reduce all the, because it seems as if we run, I know in my lab, the amount of QC that we run, the volume of QC, the cost of QC material, the repeats, and you know, it's crazy. So if we could come up with this method in which we know how to set these allowable error limits, if we understood all of that, if we were able to know what is risk and how do we set these limits for risk, how do we know when to stop? If we understood it that way versus based on SD and all these other things that we're using, I think that would make a difference. And there's a lot for me to understand, but the general concept of error, risk, and cost makes sense to me. A lot of the detail may not make sense to me, but you know, those major concepts make a lot of sense in terms of saving, in terms of risk to our patients and healthcare costs. And it seemed to me like a simpler way to approach QC in general. But I know for labs, Go ahead, Zoe.
Oh, I was just going to say it is simpler because, you know, it in essence, you put in the measured numbers of the mean and SD. The lab director says, here's my allowable error limit, your true value, I like to get it from the peer comparison program, and your acceptable risk, again, that's a medical decision, but once you've got those five numbers, you just plug it into the system, it takes a computer. You know, I can teach you how to calculate sigma. You cannot calculate cost without a computer that does it for you. It's just too complicated. But everybody's got computers. You know, the time of every Tom, Dick, and Harry making their own Excel file for QC should be passing. And the other thing is, you know, why should the people who are running the ambulance service want to stop and do something else? But they're retiring. You know, the average age of a med lab tech is 56. You know, there's a staffing shortage. Why have you got people running an ambulance when they don't have to be? If you just build that fence, you've got it built, so to speak. You save so much time that you can save whole FTEs who are putting their time into chasing ghosts with the way they're running QC now.
Yeah, that would definitely address staffing, which is one of the major issues that we're having right now. And a lot of times we don't realize that when you're repeating, when you have to repeat stuff, when you need so many people to run QC, the amount of time, that's labor, the amount of people, resources, that's cost. So you're correct. That will definitely help with staffing. Help us to reduce staffing. So it's a lot of things that I can see where, especially that risk piece, that is, if that's all that we're going to help to improve, that would be it. Well, but then it's cost, and there's so many other things that comes with it.
Right. 2011, that document was written, EP23A. It changed nothing. And yet there's so much in it that if people only followed it, and that's what I've done, is I've automated what it recommends.
So why are people doing it? What do you think? Why aren't we doing it?
Because it's not available yet, for one thing. Right now, like, this has taken me literally my life, Lona, to create. It is complicated. It has gone through many evolutions, and it is just now on the verge of coming to market. So people can't be blamed for not doing it because they don't know about it yet. And it's my job to get out there and tell them, thanks to you, you know, the more we can spread the word, the more we can get people who will step up and say, yes, you know, I'm going to come in as an early customer. I'll help these people make the best reports, because what we want to do is deliver to the labs exactly what they want. We have a dashboard that has, you know, one set for the C-suite, one for the lab director, one for the quality manager, and it goes right down to the frontline tech. You know, what's it costing me, to what do I need to do to fix it? We just need to get the word out. We need to get people trying it. We need to have the proof. And then, you know, it should, you know, my dream is to change the world. So why dream small?
Right. So basically you need people right now as early adopters to get more. Is it more data that you need, or these early adopters more? Explain that.
Actually, to use the software, and for the first, you know, 2 or 3 months, they would run it in conjunction with their existing software and then say, yes, this makes sense. I'm going to put it into place. Then publish your results. Let us know what you think. You know, we have a system spelled out for how to do it. The data you need to send to us is not complex. You've got it. It's just making those hard decisions about how, you know, estimate the cost if it failed the allowable error limit. Choose an allowable error limit that makes medical sense. And then set your acceptable risk level.
Wow. This is like, to me, a no-brainer. If you can run this along with what you're already doing and see the difference, to me, this is a no-brainer. If you're going to reduce risk, cost, and, you know, even right now with staffing and everything, to me, I think more people. So how can people actually connect with you if they want to be a site to do this, or they want to learn more about this? Zoe, how can the listeners connect with you? Because I think this is something that more labs should be really clamoring and reaching out to do.
Super. Well, I hope they agree with you, Lona. Our website is awesome-numbers.org or .com rather is the website. Mm-hmm. And my email is zoe@awesome-numbers.org.
Awesome. This is awesome. Wow. So thank you so much, Zoe, for sharing this with the listeners. You know, the word should go out, because if there's a, to me, even though there's a computer system that doing the work in the background, it's a more simplified method to do QC. And it's a more, in terms of the big concept, it makes more sense. You don't have to understand all the intricacies in the background, but the big concept of cost saving, the big concept of based on your size, your institution, the risk, the allowable risk in your environment, because you're going to have different environment. You have your medical directors making those decisions. That's the simplified version of the whole concept of, your medical directors are making decisions about what's risky for you and for your environment, and you are reducing cost and you're reducing risk, and you're basically setting your own standards, and then the calculation happens in the background. I hope I didn't mess that up.
That was very, very concise and very well done. Yes.
Okay. So Zoe is here as the expert that if you have questions, if you want to be a site of this new method that she's trying to bring to the world to save us, to reduce risk, when it comes to some of the results that we're putting out, to make sure we're putting out safe and error-free results. Zoe's here, contact her, use your lab as a site, and let's move forward with reducing risks, reducing costs, and creating better results, better quality results for our patients. So thank you so much, Zoe. Is there anything, last minute thing that you wanna say?
No, just thank you very, very much, Lona. I appreciate you helping me spread the word, and it will be exciting when to see things moving forward. We're finally ready to take a very big step.
Awesome, awesome. And thanks, Zoe. Thank you so much, our awesome guests, for being part of Elaborate Topics podcast. You can listen to this and other episodes. You can go to directimpactbroadcasting.com or any of your favorite podcast platforms. You can send us email. If you have questions on this episode, you can put your questions in when you go on to directimpactbroadcasting.com. Send us an email at elaboratetopics@directimpactbroadcasting.com. And if you want to be a guest on the show, let us know. And if you have suggestions for any topic, you can let us know at directimpactbroadcasting.com. And so have a great one.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Elaborate Topics. where your hosts discussed relevant strategies for laboratory professionals. Please subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform and listen to us on directimpactbroadcasting.com. Stay tuned for another episode with information you can use to excel in your laboratory career.